Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations for 2022, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. My guest today is Melinda Janke, an international lawyer with over 30 years of experience. Beginning her legal career in the City of London, Melinda has advised international financial institutions, governments, and multinational corporations, including oil companies. She has also spent much of her time focusing on human rights cases and is currently challenging dangerous deep water petroleum production in offshore Guyana. It's wonderful to have you here today. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's wonderful to be in the Conduit.
So let's kick off with finding out a little more about you. Who are you? What's your current role? And how did you get to the work that you're currently doing?
Well, Paul, I would say that I'm somebody that loves the earth and loves nature, and I'm prepared to fight to protect it. This planet is the only home our species has ever had. I was born in Guyana and grew up in Guyana, Zambia, Trinidad, and England. Guyana is a former British colony, so it's English-speaking. And in South American terms, it's quite small. It's just a little bit bigger than Great Britain. I went to school in England and I read law at London University and Oxford University and then worked in the city at Lovell's and then at BP. But I always knew that I would be going back to Guyana at some point. My current role is as a lawyer and I'm leading the fight to protect Guyana and also the Caribbean from ExxonMobil's dangerous deep water drilling. Now, this is taking place 120 miles offshore. The ocean is about a mile deep, and the oil is 2 miles below the seabed, so it's under extremely high pressure, and this is not what you want to be doing. Exxon has said they found more than 10 billion barrels of oil, and burning that would release 4 billion tons of carbon dioxide. That's the last thing the world needs in a climate catastrophe.
So how do you intend to... You've set out the problem. The problem is clear and evident. And I think anybody who listens to the Conduit Conversations will know that we have a rather clear view that we have to be stopping almost all fossil fuel exploration as quickly as we can and converting to sustainable sources of energy. What's your theory of change? How are you going to set out to win this particular case?
We have to have the people with us. So when Exxon first announced the oil, I just thought that this was a disaster. I knew that this was the last thing that Guyana needed. And I knew I had to tell people and get them to act. But of course, I didn't want to believe. And I got together with a few people and started a people's movement. It's called A Fair Deal for Guyana, A Fair Deal for the Planet. It's run by volunteers. And now we have hundreds of people joining in, signing letters, writing to the president and so on. I did a lot of public speaking in the media because you have to get people to understand what's going on. Until people know what it means to have an oil company in your country, you can't imagine it. So I wrote a lot of letters to the paper, did a lot of media interviews and so on. And I think over the 4 years, we're seeing a change from the initial discovery of oil and great excitement that Guyana is going to be rich to this growing realization that oil is actually about exploitation. And then the third thing, of course, is the litigation, the court cases. Having people who are prepared to say, actually, no, you're not going to come into our country and just do what you'd like. You have to obey the laws of the country. And at the moment, we've had four court cases, three that are still in the courts against the government. So the minister responsible for petroleum, the attorney general, and the Environmental Protection Agency, which is the regulatory authority, and against Big Oil, basically the subsidiaries of ExxonMobil, Hess, and the Chinese National Offshore Oil Company.
So I want to start with the the politics before we get to the law. Why is it that, other than the kind of enormous supposed or contended economic benefits, why is it that these licenses have been granted, and how powerful and important is Exxon in Guyana at this moment?
Exxon is one of the biggest oil companies. It's extremely powerful. It's very important. Exxon's resources dwarf what Guyana has. It's out of all proportion. You have this massive oil company, and then essentially what is a relatively small country. So there is this huge imbalance. The other issue is that both the government and the opposition are very keen on the oil. I think maybe what I need to do is give you, is just go back a little bit and talk about Guyana. So this is a, used to be a British colony, became independent in 1966, became a republic in 1970. And in these decades of independence, the country has been mismanaged by the political parties. And it doesn't actually matter which political party is in government. We have these decades of mismanagement in a country that is actually extremely rich. So Guyana has one, you know, mineral deposits, gold, diamonds, bauxite. It's got more than 80% covered in forest, extremely rich in biodiversity. And then if you care about these things, it's also got clean air, clean water, and it's an amazingly rich country. But the people are poor. There's a very small elite that is very rich, and then a mass of people who are struggling day to day to survive. When you have an oil company coming into that situation, it's the worst thing that can possibly happen. We've dealt with the resource curse. We know what that looks like. But the oil curse is something much, much worse.
So if you do a little bit of a back of an envelope math on 10 billion barrels, and you take the current oil price driven up artificially, indeed by the current conflict in Ukraine, at over $100 for a barrel of oil, you're talking about $1 trillion of revenue from this one deposit. And even if a small fraction of that is paid in royalties or license fees to the government, this must be an absolutely astronomical amount of money that can be deployed either for good or in the hands of elite. And obviously, it's problematic for that money to come at the cost of destroying the planet and impeding our ability to get to net zero. But how are you able to make the case, and how are you succeeding in making the case that this isn't some wonderful economic boon, but is actually something that should be resisted, particularly when the majority of citizens, as you've just said, have not benefited or are living in circumstances of poverty?
I think the answer to this is, of course, this is an economic disaster. First of all, we've seen the cost of living rising in Guyana. So housing, food, fuel, those prices have all gone up, but people's wages have not gone up. In addition to that, we've seen the loss of livelihoods. So the fishermen are complaining that they're not able now to catch fish. The government is saying that that's got nothing to do with the oil. But if you've got people drilling offshore, I think that the two are probably connected. There were promises of jobs. We were told that there would be all these jobs coming from the oil. In fact, there are very few jobs. And people are complaining that when they take jobs in the oil sector, they are ill-treated and that they're suffering from discrimination. So the supposed benefits are not there. I think there are other problems, though. One is that the fossil fuel sector is on the way down. We know that. They've got a very limited lifespan. They're not going to be around for 20 years. And essentially, the question is, well, how much damage do we allow big oil to do to this planet and to people before they are finally shut down? Now, if you look at the situation in Guyana, we're racking up debt. So when they take the oil out of the ground, 75% of that oil automatically goes to ExxonMobil and its two partners. And they're taking that oil because they say, well, These are the costs that we have incurred. So they don't pay for that oil. They just get it for free. There's no cap on their costs, and there's no limit to the time in which they can recover their costs. So they can recover their costs right up to the last barrel of oil. That leaves you with 25 barrels of oil. They take another 12 and a half, and they say, well, that's our profit. They don't pay any tax on that, so they just get that scot-free as well. And then the other 12 and a half barrels come to Guyana, and Guyana then has to sell that on the open market. Guyana has absolutely no experience whatsoever of selling oil, and therefore has to go back to the oil companies and pay them to sell the oil or hire somebody else. And then in addition to that, Guyana gets a 2% royalty. But in the meantime, they are racking up enormous costs. So the Institute for Energy, Economics and Financial Analysis estimates that by 2025, Guyana will owe about $20 billion in costs, which has to be paid out of the oil. There's another $1 billion that has come across from the previous contract that was signed in 1999. That's got to come out of Guyana's oil. And then looking down the road, we've got these other liabilities. Every single deep water well is going to have to be shut permanently and safely when the production stops. The first field development, it's going to cost $3 billion to cap those wells. Esso and their partners, they're already taking that money out. There's no guarantee that that money is going to be there when they stop production, and Guyana could well be left with that bill. And that's not unusual. It's part of what the oil industry does, is to walk away and leave somebody else with the liabilities. We see that in the United States, for example, which has some of the strongest regulation of the fossil fuel sector. So we are racking up costs all of the time for something that is very short term, maybe 5 years, but who knows?
So let's start with the work that you are doing in the specific court case. It's predicated on a constitutional argument, as I understand it. And that in turn is based on the actual content of the Constitution. And as I understand it, back in 2002, you actually did some work in reframing the Constitution. So take us back to then and explain what you did, and then we'll draw the connection between the past and the present.
So in 2002, the government of Guyana decided that they would have a constitution reform exercise. And it occurred to me that this would be a good time to put into the constitution a right to a healthy environment. It was already happening in other countries, but not enough. And at the time, it seemed a little bit daring for the government of Guyana. But I did a lot of research. I lobbied consistently. I mean, I think I probably just made a nuisance of myself. And in the end, the commission said, yes, we agree. We will put a right to a healthy environment into the constitution. And they looked at different constitutions. And what we have in the Guyana constitution is based on the constitution of South Africa.
And what does that provision say?
It says that everyone has the right to a healthy environment, and that the government will take reasonable legislative and other measures to protect the environment for present and future generations.
So anybody who's listened to Conduit Conversations will know that we're very interested in how small groups of committed citizens can wield power asymmetrically against corporations or governments or other powerful groups who may be taking actions that either place vulnerable communities at risk or nations at risk or the entire planet at risk. And you have used a provision in the Constitution around the right to a clean and healthy environment to bring this court case. So tell us precisely how you've used it and how that's being received.
Do you know, it feels strange to be going to court and arguing on the basis of a provision that I know is in the Constitution because of the lobbying that I did. And looking at it, it's just a very strange feeling. What we're doing in this case is challenging all of the oil production and basically asking the court to decide whether it's compatible with the right to healthy environment. The case is brought by a dean at the University of Ghana, Dr. Troy Thomas, and a young man, Kodad De Freitas, who is an indigenous Wapichan from the south of Guyana. And what we're arguing in the case is that, look, fossil fuel production emits greenhouse gases, and that has an impact on the climate system. It has an impact on the ocean. It's going to contribute to rising sea levels. That does not make for a healthy environment, and the government has a duty to protect the citizens of Guyana from a deteriorating climate, from an ocean becoming more acidic, and so on. And that is the basis of the case. We're asking the court to say that in allowing ExxonMobil to go ahead to produce 10 billion barrels of oil, which will result in more than 4 billion tons of greenhouse gas, that this is incompatible with a healthy environment and incompatible with the state's duty to protect the environment.
So let's explore how this is being received, because if you followed that argument to its logical conclusion, we should immediately halt and cease and desist from doing any fossil fuel exploration. And have you made the argument that it is the per se exploitation of fossil fuels that violates these provisions in the Constitution, or it's the quantum of them in this particular case which makes this so egregious?
So the argument that we should stop all fossil fuel exploration now has already been made by the International Energy Agency. So they told us last year there's no need for any new fossil fuel exploration. That's an energy agency. That's the industry spokesbody. If they're saying don't do new fossil fuels, then I think any government ought to take that very seriously. In terms of whether it's the quantum or it's just the emissions, this is a very unusual situation because what Guyana is looking to do is increase its emissions at a time when just about every country on the planet has agreed to cut emissions. So in Guyana's nationally determined contribution submitted under the Paris Agreement, the government said that subject to funding, Guyana would go 100% renewable by 2025. To do oil and gas is incompatible with that. So we have these obligations. Now, you can argue, yes, the Paris Agreement isn't binding. It hasn't been put into legislation in Guyana. But we have said in the court documents that in interpreting the right to a healthy environment, the court has to look at another provision in the Constitution which says that when you look at the fundamental rights, you have to take into account international law. And that's a very useful provision for us. And interpreting the right to healthy environment, we're also asking the court to look at another provision in the Constitution which says the well-being of the nation depends on clean air, clean water, rich biodiversity, etc. And that's a provision that I wrote in 2002 and which the Commission accepted and which the Parliament accepted and which is now in the Constitution. So we've sort of come full circle.
Have you had any clue as to how this argument is being received by the judges?
Not by the judges as yet, but what we do have is the next stage of the proceedings. So we filed the claim. The judge added ESSO as a defendant, and the Attorney General and ESSO have put in their defences. And without sort of boring listeners with the details, in summary, ESSO is denying that when you burn fossil fuels, you get greenhouse gases, denying climate change, denying that this makes the ocean more acid, denying that this will contribute to rising sea levels, denying the impacts on future generations, denying that this will have long-term effects, and so on.
That seems to me to be an astonishing position to be taking in 2022. That may have been acceptable 5 years ago or a decade ago, but sophisticated oil companies are no longer in the position of climate deniers. They are buying offsets, talking about the need to make a slow and orderly transition, talking about energy independence, talking about costs to consumers and ordinary citizens and households. But almost nobody is doing flat-out climate change denial or seeking to argue that there's no connection between fossil fuel exploration or the use of fossil fuels and the climate crisis. So is that something that both in court but outside court you are seeking to draw both regulators, governments, and the public as a whole's attention to?
It hasn't actually resonated with the public. People don't seem to have been as shocked by it as one would expect them to be, particularly when you think back to October last year and the United States Congress, where the chairman and chief executive officer of ExxonMobil, Darren Woods, actually said on oath, ExxonMobil has long recognized that climate change is real and has serious consequences. Now, he's saying that on oath to the US Congress, a few thousand miles away, ExxonMobil's subsidiary is saying the complete opposite. And I think this is a very interesting dynamic. Everything that I'm saying to you, of course, is in the public domain. It's there for the journalists who want to pick it up. At the moment, no one seems that interested in picking it up. I think what's also extraordinary, if I may, is in addition to denial by a corporation or a government, we don't even get that in the judiciary now. There are so many cases in which the judges have said climate change is real, climate change is a threat, we are on the edge of catastrophe. So the judiciary, by and large, across the globe, is accepting that climate change is real and is catastrophic. So to see this in court documents, this denial, is a little surprising, to say the least.
Given what's at stake, and given how beneficial it would be to the planet, to the citizens of Guyana, and to an unfolding body of climate law, which is appropriately directing attention to the impacts of fossil fuel, both exploration and exploitation, what more can be done here in the United Kingdom, or by ordinary citizens, or by allied lawyers to increase the chances that this case might win, or similarly situated cases might lead to beneficial outcomes?
I think there are a number of things that people can do. One of the most important is actually telling the truth. So we know what's in the court documents. It's really important that people understand what these cases are about. This is only one of the cases, although we have another case which is challenging flaring by ExxonMobil's subsidiary, and they have admitted to flaring billions of cubic feet of gas. That's a very bad thing for the planet. It's also really shocking. Guyana is on the route for bird migration. These birds are coming from North America. They come to Guyana, they rest, and then they carry on down south. They now have to fly through an area with this constant flaring, and we have no idea what that's doing to bird migration. It's really important that groups who are passionate about birds actually get involved in this, because it's impossible for us to do everything. The case is very interesting because one of the difficulties is that Exxon is actually admitted to using faulty equipment, and that's why they say that they have to flare. We have a third case, which is currently in the Court of Appeal, challenging the petroleum production license on the grounds that the minister acted unlawfully. He granted a license to Esso and Hess and CNOOC. Only Esso has an environmental permit, and we argue that the Environmental Protection Act does not allow you to obtain a license unless you have a permit. That case is in the Court of Appeal. And we've had a fourth case where we won and we cut Exxon's environmental permits down to 5 years. The first permit runs out on the 31st of May 2022 and not the 31st of December 2040. So that opens up space for public engagement and discussion on whether a new permit should be granted and under what conditions.
If your court case were to win, if you were to prevail, does the raw politics of what's happening on the ground mean that essentially this production will stop, be ordered to stop, and it's going to go away? Or do you anticipate a series of both challenges but also morphs from Exxon and its subsidiaries in order to be able to either circumvent the ruling or find a new theory for which they could continue exploration?
I think whatever happens, it's going to be a fight. That's the reality. We are asking the court to make a declaration, so we're not asking for orders to shut down the oil. We're asking the court to declare what the law is, and then we expect to ensure that whatever it's doing is in line with the declaration of law made by the court. This is a really interesting situation, though, because it's an unprecedented situation. Guyana is a carbon sink. By that, what that means is that our forests take out more greenhouse gas than we produce. So we're climate heroes. We're helping the rest of the world to breathe. And this is exactly what everybody else should be doing, is actually moving from being carbon emitters to becoming carbon sinks and removing the excess greenhouse gas from the atmosphere. Instead, we have this situation where the government wants to go from being a carbon sink to being a carbon bomb and to undo everything that our forests are doing. We're part of the Amazon forest. Those forests don't belong to the government. They belong to the people of Guyana.
One of the backdrop arguments that we've seen at COP in discussing the Paris Agreements has been that developing economies have disproportionately borne the loss and damage of climate change, and that developed economies have got wealthy while burning the overwhelming preponderance of fossil fuels, and that therefore there has to be a mechanism to both compensate for that loss. There has to be a recognition in law that that disparity exists. And it seems to me that this court case fits into that narrative. Britain, a former colonial power in this instance, is not necessarily bearing any responsibility or shouldering any blame, not just for the fact that it was a colonial power, but also for the fact that it basically got wealthy during a period of time when fossil fuels could be burnt with less restrictions or less mindfulness about the future. Are there things that can be done to offset that narrative? Are there things that the UK can and should be doing in relation to this court case to make what is an economic loss, at least some economic loss, more palatable if Guyana does the right thing for the environment and therefore by extension for the rest of the world?
So the oil is not going to make Guyana richer. It's going to make Guyana poorer. And that's one of the reasons that we are so keen to ensure that the oil companies obey the law. We have very strong laws in Guyana, and it's essential that anybody that comes into the country respects the rule of law, hence the court cases. And there are more court cases that could be filed if the resources were available. When we talk about the imbalance and the injustice, I think we've said so much about this, and we know Guyana is already suffering the impacts of climate change and that we're not responsible for. We've had flooding last year. The president declared a national disaster. We've had flooding in the city. My house has been flooded. I've had fish in my study, and it's very charming to see them in between the bookshelves, but that's not really where they ought to be. And when you have a country with a coast that is low-lying and some of it is below sea level and protected by a very small seawall, then for the national government to decide in 2022 that oil production, fossil fuels, is a good way to go is actually grossly irresponsible. So yes, the Global North must take responsibility for what it has done, but the government today must take responsibility for what it is doing and trying to do, which is essentially contributing to the destruction of the country that it is elected to serve.
So I'm going to end with a final thought, because it seems to me what you've sketched out here is actually quite extraordinary. If this amount of economic activity is not going to make a country wealthier and is going to, in aggregate, subject the planet to incredible, arguably existential harm, the only people who benefit is a lawless climate-denying corporation and potentially a set of economic and political elites that may be officially or unofficially benefiting from this exploitation. Is there any other way to understand this particular case?
I think that's the story of oil that you have just described. Whenever you look at countries that are former colonies that have oil, it's a disaster for the majority of people, whether it's Nigeria, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Angola. I mean, for us, we only have to look next door to Venezuela, and we can see the devastation that has occurred because of oil. And our Venezuelan sisters and brothers are coming to Guyana. They're leaving. They're coming to us for refuge. And we are taking care of them because these are our sisters and brothers. So when you talk about the oil companies and the benefits to them and a small elite, that is the story of oil. And that is the story that we don't want in Guyana. You mentioned the COP. Before President Ali went to the COP last year, Guyanese citizens wrote to him and said that the evidence is irrefutable, global warming is affecting the earth, and we want you to take a strong position at the COP. We want you to go there and demand that every state takes urgent action to cut their greenhouse gas emissions. The letter said, "We demand that the industrialized nations undo the damage to the Earth's climate system by removing their historic greenhouse gas emissions from the atmosphere." And the letter continued, "We demand that the people of Guyana are paid for the greenhouse gas that our forests are removing. As the owners of the forests, we demand that the payments are made to the people of Guyana, not to the government." And in light of our unique historic contribution to mitigating climate change, we demand payment at the rate of $80 a ton. We reserve the right to increase our price in the future. That's the way forward. That's climate leadership. That's taking care of the planet. And that's also what will help to make people materially better off so that everybody can lead a decent life. Not a small elite that becomes super rich, but equality across the country.
Melinda Janki, that's been a remarkable conversation. For anybody who wants to know more about your work or this particular case, can you point us to a few resources that people who may want to support or who are curious could look at?
Yes, absolutely. So there is the website, A Fair Deal for Guyana, A Fair Deal for the Planet. There's also a moratorium, a demand for a moratorium on the oil and gas, and it would be wonderful if people were able to sign that. And there's a link to it on the website. There's also my website, which has some of the information, and it's easy to contact me from there.
And your website is?
MelindaJanki.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation. We're honored to have had you.
Paul, thank you so much for having me here. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about Melinda and her work, please go to her website. And for more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.